the U.S. government is taking a 10% stake in Intel.
The analogy I've got is just like we couldn't give an API to our ops people, giving an AI coding tool to a developer is actually the wrong thing to do.
This is, I guess, the part of the show where we say this is not investment advice.
Fund flows are primarily coming at institutional level now.
MIT Nanda, attention-grabbing headline saying 95% of AI deployment has failed.
Quantum hashing is more than half a century away. It's just the wallets, you know, could be vulnerable within a decade, possibly half of that.
But why are they able to make such rapid progress at a time when others are sort of struggling to get to really high-end manufacturing?
Welcome to the OrionX Download Podcast. Join Shaheen Khan, the OrionX analysts, and special guests as they discuss and simplify the big ideas and technology that are changing the world. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the OrionX Download Analyst Roundtable. As usual, with me are Adrian Cockcroft, Chris Kruhl, Stephen Perrineau. Good to see you all today.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, without further ado, let's start right where we started last time around, which is Adrian's experimentation with AI agent swarm coding and all the implications thereof.
Yeah, I haven't actually done any more coding in the last couple of the weeks because I've been mostly offline without any internet connection, and I've relocated to the UK for a few months. So that's been, that nothing's been really happening there, but some ideas were sort of percolating and marinating, and I eventually decided that rather than writing a whole Medium story about it, I wrote it as a LinkedIn post. And just sort of trying out some ideas. And it's got a lot of engagement, a lot of comments, and a few people pushing back, but most people saying that it makes some kind of sense to them. And what was happening was, it's something like the, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. It's that kind of thing, right? So what can you see from previous patterns? And what I saw in the early days of cloud was a lot of pushback from people saying, this doesn't work. You can't run a business on it. And a lot of the people that were pushing back were the ops people and the CIOs. And it took a long time for them to get comfortable with cloud, you know, many years. But in the early days, they couldn't conceive of, you know, not running in a data center. And, you know, if you went up to some operations person, they weren't coders. They did a bit of scripting, but mostly they were hands-on people, you know, putting stuff in data centers and running around. And if you gave them an API, they didn't know what to do with it. But what we did at Netflix, we just did an end run around them and said, no, we're going to use our developers to deploy all of our operations, the infrastructure, by just calling these APIs and coding against AWS. So that was the transition there. And in the early days, it was kind of, it was a bit flaky and there were things that didn't work, but we made it work. We worked around the issues and we got ahead, and a few people tried to copy us. It took a few years before, I mean, I'm talking about kind of 2010 era cloud, and when I first started talking about it publicly. And then in about 2012, it was pretty obviously working for a few people. In 2013, 2014, we started seeing Capital One, for example, say, okay, we're going to go do cloud for a bank. That was one of the early sort of enterprise endorsements. So if we come to look at AI with through that same lens, we're still at that sort of 2010 period right now, where if you work around the issues, you can make it work. And there is a lot of naysayers out there, people that say it's never going to work. But there are people saying, no, I'm actually getting something useful done with this, and I can see where it's going to work and figuring out how to make it. And I'm particularly talking about AI coding here. And the analogy I've got is just like we couldn't give an API to our ops people, giving an AI coding tool to a developer is actually the wrong thing to do, because they will just try and micromanage it to produce the output that they would have written anyway. Whereas what you really want to do is give these tools to product managers who are technical enough to understand, you know, the technologies and basically, if you've heard of the different things, but you actually don't know how to code them, right? So you want to give it to somebody who has a clear idea of the product they're trying to build and can tell whether it's being built or not, and is used to telling a group of engineers to go off and try and build something, and they come back with something that's different from what you wanted, same as the AI. So you have to kind of wrangle them into building the thing you actually want. And that management style product-driven management style is, I think, the right place to give the tool to. And then there's still some tech, some platform engineering. You still need some deep developers around, but they're not just like we needed some ops experience around in the old days for cloud, but it's not the mainstream anymore. Anyway, I wrote this up. A few people thought it was interesting. And the follow-up question you get to is, well, how do you hire these developers? What do they look like? What's the hiring exercise look like? Because they aren't developers, they're sort of product people that know how to use the AI tools. So there's probably going to be a different kind of role. It might come up with a new name. Like, you know, we have like DevOps engineers didn't exist in 2010. They came along later. And that's sort of that development operations cloud management thing. That's what it ended up being called. So there's probably a name for this skill set that's going to arrive eventually, and people will figure out how to tell whether you're good at it or not.
There was also some discussion on its impact on org charts.
Yeah, it's a different org chart because you want to have it be product driven, right? You want all the product and the engineering to just be in one organization rather than having a separate organization that's the technologists that go off and build things and the business is over there. Like one of the things at Netflix, there was never, the business was the technology organization. It was a product organization. There wasn't business. There were the people that bought movies or the people that made movies, but that wasn't really the business, right? The business was the services we were creating, and it wasn't separated out. It was a fully integrated organization. I think that's the other aspect of it that will work. So I'm expecting some new companies to form with these new architectures, new organizations, and figure out how to iterate and build something more interesting quickly.
So I'm sensing, and I've been seeing it as a major, major breakthrough. Is that how you see it? Is this something that once people figure it out, it's going to have very far-reaching impact on the whole software development industry in general?
Yeah, I think it is. And it's also moving much faster. It's sort of months instead of years in terms of the pace at which this is changing. It's not capital intensive, so it's limited by how fast you can build the code that you need to sort of implement some of these ideas and how fast the ideas can percolate. And right now we're in a mode where code can be built super quickly because of that's what this whole thing's about. And ideas are percolating incredibly quickly. So I think that we've got very little friction in this space. And then there's an enormous amount of investment from the AI companies as they're following along, trying to implement what people are building. But right. I'm still seeing startups trying to build things for kind of last year's world, right? Where they're baking in the slow way of producing something and the slow approach to, you know, the old world, right? And I think I think there's a new world emerging here, and it's going to be pretty disruptive to startups, enterprises, and everybody. And it's going to be also very, very chaotic because some small segments are going to go deep and fast and others are going to be slow. And it's going to be very confusing because it's going to work in some places and not others, just because it's moving too fast to be uniform.
So NVIDIA has been the beacon of this entire area, and they announced their earnings last week, and they reported $46.7 billion in revenues for the quarter, which was a 6% increase from the prior quarter and 56% increase year over year. Nevertheless, the stock dropped a little bit because this was the slowest growth they've had in the past 2 years. So they couldn't beat their own record, even though they're growing by leaps and bounds. And I think that led folks to worry whether we are approaching the tapering part of the S-curve, if there is one, and maybe power law will stop working for NVIDIA. What do you guys think about that?
I have a comment on a power law, which is a log periodic power law analysis of how the price waves have behaved in Bitcoin and NVIDIA in particular. And you can use similar analysis. I just did this last week, and it shows a continuation into next spring, into the March timeframe. It's very interesting. This comes out of geophysics originally and modeling earthquakes and avalanches and so forth. And you get waves of things happening closer and closer together. And you can fit that pretty nicely on the NVIDIA stock price, including a pullback like we just had is very consistent with the last little peak that we saw. And it's suggesting in March is when you might hit a critical steepness, because what happens is these things get closer and closer together, but they also steepen.
Right, right. And that, I guess
that's saying, you know, something like price might get up to, you know, over 300 is possible. Wow.
Well, this is, I guess, the part of the show where we say this is not investment advice or any kind of advice. So your mileage will vary, et cetera. But
absolutely.
That's quite interesting.
But more generally, I think you're just seeing the usual reaction of people now looking forward instead of backwards. Yes, you had a very good quarter. Is the momentum for AI being sustained in the market in general? And are there issues with respect to the Chinese revenue portion?
It's only a $4 trillion company at this point. It could probably get bigger. I don't know. But there's no real... I think the thing with NVIDIA, they don't have a clear competitor at scale at this point, right? They have a big chunk of the market, and the market is still pretty nascent and emerging. And I think there's still plenty to go. But you know, the expectations, you know, you can just see... Maybe they'll peak on the stock price, only so big they can get there. But in terms of the business itself, I still don't really see an alternative out there that's succeeding at scale.
Well, it comes down to your view of how much is the infrastructure developed and how many people can afford building large scale data centers for AI. What's the appetite? Does the investment profile shift to the actual application front as opposed to the back end? But yes, we do have this recent report from MIT Nanda, attention-grabbing headline saying 95% of AI deployment is failed. You know, basically what their premise is, they looked at 300-something companies during the first 6 months of 2025. They're seeing that a lot of people have deployed more on the front end kinds of things. They're looking at the media segment and the tech segments as being the leaders on that front. Adrian has touched on this before with his development kinds of discussions. And one of their points is that for those who have experimented with it, there's not been a lot of wide-scale deployment on the back end where they see the biggest leverage for ROI. You've got people dabbling on how do I write a blurb for this website kinds of things. We've got coders becoming more efficient in their programming. I just think it's early days to be making these kinds of grand pronouncements that AI is failing. You know, just think back. You know, we've all lived through the deployment of ERP, and you know, it took a while before ERP gathered the momentum to actually make the big changes to lead to productivity and shifting in employment patterns. CRM, you know, more recently is, you know, again, the same thing, right? We've all played in that world too. And it takes a while. I think it was Ben Thompson. I can't remember if it was Ben Thompson. So maybe somebody else made the point that small companies will probably see the benefit of AI investment or AI tool deployment more easily than large enterprises. Enterprises have messy data pools, they have data silos that they need to work with. A smaller organization, a startup, can start from scratch and develop that AI infrastructure much more easily and much more quickly and much more effectively than somebody who's got a lot of entrenched applications and skill sets and so forth. So, you know, that's part of the report too, is that it's not so much a system or tool failure as it is a learning failure. You know, the tools aren't learning across the organization the way that helps make them more productive for ROI purposes.
So my take is that when you have 95% failure, it follows that there's appetite for risk, that people are willing to jump in without having crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's, and which is what typically enterprises do. And that means having a seat at the table is more important than anything else. That project failure or success needs to be defined a different way. It's not about the project. It's about moving in this particular direction. And we've seen it many times that when a market makes up its mind that it's going to pursue this particular path, it is willing to under-optimize everything else to pursue it.
You know, as you're talking, one of the things that jumps to mind is, you know, an earthquake in Japan could very well set off a tsunami for us on the west coast of the US, right? It takes a while for it to get there, but it gets there. I think we'll see the impact.
The other thing I want to say is we also could segment the market and say, okay, where is AI demand coming from? Well, obviously the super big guys are building their own chips. So every time you use the Google AI assistant, you're kind of using their TPUs in all likelihood, even though they do have NVIDIA chips as well.
It's a mixture, I think.
It is a mixture. Yeah. But those chips are doing something, right? So that's one way to segment it. The other way to segment it is that there's learning and then there's inference. And inference is really what brings it to the front office, adds a bit of an OLTP flavor to it. The economics of deployment become a little bit more OLTP, like online transaction processing type. And then it's, what are we trying to do? If you look at OpenAI and Anthropic and Google and some of the, again, super Meta, super big guys, I don't think those guys are too worried about making money right now. They're trying to pursue AGI and superintelligence and building a capability that is globally unique and plays at a different level. And I think those guys will just carry on, and they're a substantial piece of the demand. So now the enterprise gets a little bit put into perspective because A, they're using the cloud, in which case they probably don't really care what the chip is, and they're incorporating, integrating it with the rest of the software stack that they have. So I think if you look at it that way, then it seems to me that the demand might have occasional hiccups, but it's, you know, just the secular demand is going to continue to grow because this thing is just starting. Now, I know that if you're in the financial market, megatrends aren't interesting. You want to get it right. You know, you want to know what happens next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. And there I can't help you.
But some enterprises generally don't have budget for innovation.
Right.
Right. You don't say, hey, I've got this big idea. It needs lots of money. Oh, we haven't got money for that. But then they started getting scared. And there was basically a FOMO budget, fear of missing out budget for AI. Right. Right. And it was actually, I heard even board level people at boards talking to execs saying, well, where's your AI project? You should go invest some money in this, serious money in it to go do something.
Absolutely.
So that is, I mean, the pump in some sense. And those are, a lot of those will fail because it's just like money chasing something to do. So it's coming because of FOMO rather than because of bottom up. It's top down. And it may end up funding some good things, but the more bottom-up stuff I'm hearing about is where somebody that's just got, you know, they just work on a spreadsheet every day and it takes them a few hours and they just use ChatGPT to code it. And now it takes 30 seconds to do the thing that was just moving stuff around. It wasn't, you know, it was just an annoying thing that took them time, right? That kind of stuff, that kind of productivity improvement where somebody can go and build a spreadsheet or some code or something to automate away their own work without them being even a developer. That kind of stuff is what permeates bottom up through an organization.
That's right. I'm reminded of your comment, Adrian, a couple of episodes ago when you said the ROI for me is infinity because I wouldn't even attempt it without this capability.
I would not be writing code at all. I don't have time to write code. I have time to tell Claude to write code for me occasionally. Right. And it's produced mass quantities of code that I then I feel obligated to test it enough to make sure it works. Right. So I spend probably a bit more time on that. But still, this is stuff I don't know how to do. It would take me too long to learn how to be a productive developer in technologies I'm using to build things.
Yeah. So it is really expanding the set of folks who are going to actually build capabilities, digital capabilities, and this will be part of that. Now, Stanford has an AI index report that they do every year, and the 2025 edition came out a couple of months ago. They talk about global competition in AI, which obviously is impacting geopolitics. They talked about ethics and governance, which I think remains a murky area in terms of how different geographies are approaching it. They talked about rapid progress. They talk about more accessible AI as costs drop. And of course, as you make progress, that happens. But of course, they also talked about business adoption, which dovetails quite nicely with the MIT report and the 95% failure and the discussion that we just had. Now, switching a little bit to quantum, because that's another big mega trend, MIT has done something similar to the Stanford AI Index and calling it the MIT Quantum Index Report. Both of them have a wonderful collection of data, so highly recommend that you Google it and go to their website. They have interactive data navigation, etc. So they talk about the overall investment in quantum computing. In 2024, $1.6 billion went into quantum computing, and something like $0.6 billion went to quantum software. So those are the two areas that are getting investment. As a whole area, my take is that nothing really substantially has changed in terms of the status of quantum technologies. There's quantum sensing for measurement, which has been a market and continues to be a market, and that is a real area. Then there is quantum communication that is rapidly progressing. And then there's quantum computing, where the big prize is. And there, really, one has to make a distinction between a quantum physics instrument that has some parameters that you can set and it runs experiments, and an actual programmable and reprogrammable quantum computer, which is exactly what has been elusive so far. But there is a lot of progress there as well. They talked about patents, lots of patents since 2014 to 2024 is the window they looked at. As of 2024, China has 60% of the patent portfolio. Now, patent is not exactly the best metric because it really depends on the kind of patent. My analogy is that it's like real estate. You could own a lot of land, but you know, if it's downtown New York City, it has a bit of a difference. Quantity doesn't quite point to whether or not it's valuable. And then they talked about skill set. And then they also talked about quantum safe cryptography, which of course is not quantum computing or quantum technology. It is sort of the unquantum market because you're afraid of quantum computing, not that you're using it, although there are a couple of algorithms that could use it. So maybe that's a good segue into whatever we want to discuss about quantum, but also get a bit of a crypto update from Steve.
Sure. Well, I think the quantum threat against Bitcoin, crypto more generally, is still some time off, but it's not too early to think about. And so it has been given thought, and there's more than one Bitcoin improvement proposal. And we've already got the quantum safe cryptographic algorithms approved by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They've been through years of vetting, and several are now improved. And so it's certainly possible to create a wallet that's safe. The blockchain itself is not an issue. Quantum hashing is more than half a century away. It's just the wallets, which is a whole different algorithm, the Shor's algorithm, not the Grover's algorithm, that you know could be vulnerable within a decade, possibly half of that. But we're going to need thousands and thousands of logical qubits before that becomes an issue. And you know, we're only at kind of several currently. So we've got time there. More generally, two main interesting things I want to mention about Bitcoin and really the crypto market as a whole are that the fund flows are primarily coming at institutional level now. So if we look in really during 2025, about three quarters of the net increase in holdings, the net buying, is coming from the Bitcoin treasury companies. So that's companies like Strategy, which used to be called MicroStrategy, but there are now many others. There are more than 150 of these companies that have announced and are starting to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And some are small, but some are pretty darn large. And there have been some quite substantial capital raises as well, up into the billions, to fund some of the new ones. And it turns out that if you combine that with the ETFs that made such a big splash during 2024, and which are most of the other 25% of the net buying that's going on the market, that for those categories of institutional purchasing, since Bitcoin was age 10, which is now almost 7 years ago, the holdings have been increasing as a very rapid power law with the fourth power of Bitcoin's age. And that's really the principal driver now between adoption and price as well. The other thing I wanted to mention is the Tether announcement, which just happened in the past week or so. They announced native support for Bitcoin. Most of the Tether activity has been on the Ethereum chain. And so the production of Tether happens on the Ethereum chain. But they've now announced capability for a second layer solution. And that's going to allow you to have one wallet that holds both Bitcoin and Tether simultaneously and to be interoperable down the road with Lightning as well. And most of the information, all the meta information, the smart contract information will be off-chain. So it'll be validated on the Bitcoin blockchain, but most of the data can reside off the chain in order to have better scalability. And as a second layer, it's going to be much more rapid. So I think that's quite important. The stable coins are just becoming more and more important. And in fact, they're seen as another form of what we call euro dollar or shadow banking or, you know, just dollars held overseas.
So the other thing that happened was the annual Hot Chips Conference that is held at the Stanford campus, right across from the Hoover Tower, and always a technology, academic, deep topic kind of a conference, but has been gaining in popularity consistent with the growth of interest in chips in general. So in person, there were something like 500 people attending. Rumor was it that maybe there's another 1,300 or so that were online because people, they did stream it, and it was wonderful that they did. So people from around the world were actually dialing in. I just want to highlight one talk, and that was the second keynote by Dr. Koike, who is the CEO of Rapidus. Now, Rapidus is a Japanese company formed by a consortium of the who's who of Japanese technology firms with the intent to reestablish high-end manufacturing capability for Japan. So it's a very focused effort between the Japanese government, the local governments, the industry, and even the construction companies that were working to build the actual sites that they have, beautiful, beautiful buildings that they have done. So no pun intended, these guys are doing really rapid progress. They already do like early samples now. I think they're going to perfect that over the next year. So in 2026, they will start shipping some or producing some and be in volume production in 2027, by which time they will be doing something like 5,000 wafers per month. And these wafers are 30 centimeter plates. So depending on the size of your chips or chiplets, you can figure out how many chips you're going to get out of that. It's hundreds to thousands to even tens of thousands, depending on how tiny they get. But why are they able to make such rapid progress at a time when others are sort of struggling to get to really high-end manufacturing? Now, at the moment, there are only four companies in the world that have a shot at doing this. One is TSMC, which is really the NVIDIA of chip manufacturing, massive volume, really untouchable, leading the way. Right behind them has been Samsung, who are maybe just a little bit behind, but they can still do sub 5-nanometer fabrications. Then Intel, which continues to be a big behemoth in that market with really deep technology, actually forming and inventing a bunch of the stuff that everybody else is using right now. Funny, by the way, in parentheses, is the impact of Department of Energy and U.S. research establishments in how some of these technologies have come about and invented, like Livermore Labs, for example, which the HPC folks would be happy to hear.
Is Samsung, I mean, for me, that's associated with things like flash memory and stuff. Do they each focus on different parts of the technology?
No, these are all logic manufacturers. For memory, it's Samsung, Micron, and Hynix, right. SK Hynix, that do kind of high-end. And Micron is doing this $100 billion investment in upstate New York near Syracuse, not too far away from Ithaca, where Chris and I went to school.
So you're saying Samsung is doing logic. So what CPU, what are they building for who?
So Qualcomm is probably a well-known one. IBM is using them for Power 10 and Power 11. And speaking of IBM, they also collaborate with Rapidus. IBM offloaded their chip manufacturing capabilities to GlobalFoundries some years ago, but they continue with high-end R&D. So they actually showed sub 2-nanometers production capability in their R&D. They were first to do that. So they are collaborating with Rapidus, and they will continue to do so in addition to the people that we talked about. So those are the four people doing high-end manufacturing, and Rapidus really is the fourth one that is joining in a very prominent way. So the question is, why? How are they able to do this, right? So part of it, of course, is the focused attention that they're all behind this arrow, that they're getting support from everybody to go to this. The other one is that they were focusing on single wafer perfection before doing batch. So instead of focusing on a lot of wafers at the same time, which you have to wait and then come back, they do one single wafer at a time. So interesting, incredible expansion of the set of companies that can do this, additional capacity in the market. Now they have to go land customers, but that's the other thing that is emerging, that if you're a country and you're trying to build a national capability, then you kind of care less about whether it's going to make money immediately. you're having a longer term view, and that sort of upends how kind of markets work and capitalism works. The other thing that came out during the show, albeit it was announced separately, was NVIDIA's quote-unquote scale across, which is reminiscent of grid computing that we all did some years ago, multi-building, multi-campus, multi-city networking, and it has co-packaged silicon photonics capabilities that NVIDIA launched at GTC in March. Adrian, you wrote about it in your Medium article, and it is low latency, high bandwidth, longer distance networking that they were talking about. And I don't know if you guys have any perspective on that. I'm kind of hard pressed to think that a single application is going to span multiple buildings, but maybe.
If it's inference, you can just keep going horizontally, right? It's each request is basically independent. It's the ones that are hard to scale are the training ones where you're shuffling all the data around and you're solving a monolithic problem. So I think the inference is definitely scalable and distributable. You've got the model that you're using gets big, so it takes a lot of memory. But
wouldn't you be able to just shard your way to happiness and not have to interconnect things?
It should be much less network intensive.
Yeah, I think you just want to move workload around probably more so than, you know.
I see. Like load balancing.
Single shared memory image. Yeah, it's probably more of a load balancing system management function.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's something to watch.
The other thing I noticed just talking about NVIDIA is I think they now have the Blackwell Ultra. That's the next version of Blackwell. We've just about maybe got Blackwell working at scale. And there's a new one to play with, right?
So, well, you call that indigestion.
Whatever it is, another 50% faster or something like that, right? So everyone has indigestion over, I just bought this thing and it's already obsolete and it's not working yet.
Well, NVIDIA has attempted to make a case that in the post-Moore's Law era that we live in, things don't go obsolete, that it's just fine, keep using it. I'm not sure everybody's buying that story, but there is some truth to it. You know, you're not going to keep waiting. You're going to have to enter the fray at some point.
Yeah.
And then you're stuck with your investment, and it's not a bad investment, so keep using it. It's fine.
You briefly and glancingly touched on country investment in technology, and we didn't touch on the fact that the U.S. government is taking a 10% stake in Intel. And those kinds of investments, you know, when you have the intersection of national security concern with key technologies, I think it's a good move. Because we're at the end of the day, Intel and others here domestically need to compete with those government-funded entities overseas that have just taken over chip production in this case. So I don't know if you want to say more about that.
There's a weird ideological sort of mind twist here, because it's basically nationalization. You're saying that nationalized industries are doing better than private industry. And you know, I think the UK is about to nationalize its rail service, I think, because it all failed. You know, it got privatized years ago and it's failed. So that was sort of not the dogma for a long time, right? So,
oh, of course not. Of course not. And it is a tightrope. I will say that. I mean, but when I think about investment in chip technology, chip production, that's a long horizon that I don't know if, you know, Wall Street and the financially oriented thinkers have the patience for. And you take that intersecting with, again, coming back to national security, I've always thought it's a good idea for us to have a better handle on those technologies that we put into things that we trust for our security.
Yeah, I think if the Democrats were trying to do that, the Republicans would be claiming this was socialism and shooting it down. I mean, to some extent, they can get away with it because Republicans saying that they want to do it, right? It's a bit odd for that reason. It's sort of, again, they're effectively doing the opposite of what they say they want to do.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see this as the U.S. government saying Intel must succeed.
Yes.
Which I like. That part we all like because it is part of national security and you're building a national capability and you'd like to support it. Now, how that interest manifests itself is really the question. You could subsidize it, you could give it a grant, you could give it a loan, you could take an equity stake. To me, that's kind of the financial engineering part of it that is a little bit more direct than sort of building the environment in which companies can succeed. But I do think, as we discussed last time around, it goes to the heart of how do you fund national security? To what extent can you rely on markets to do it for you? What are the conditions that need to be in place for markets to be able to do that? What do you do when those conditions are not in place and the markets are unable to do it?
I just see this as double entry bookkeeping. It was already decided that you want to do, that you want to have a relationship because of national security. So you had the CHIPS Act and the Science Act, and you invested in Intel. You gave them some money.
That's right.
So that was one side of the ledger. This is the other side of the ledger.
Yeah.
That's saying, oh, right. You know, we're going to participate because we gave you some money. We think you're important, but that means we should be participating.
Yeah. Good point.
Well, also something to watch, but I think this is a very critical concept outside of this particular case. And certainly if it becomes more of a pattern, then I think it deserves a deeper discussion. Very well. Well, on that note, we should conclude this episode and let everybody get back to their activities. Thank you all for listening. Thank you guys for being here. Until next time, take care.
Okay. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the OrionX Download Podcast. Every episode is posted to orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comment section or tweet us with any questions or proposed topics of discussion. If you like the show, rate, review, and share it. The OrionX Download Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.